It's a magazine. You don't have to feel obligated to buy from your nephew's fundraiser. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, free on your radio. Now. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Happy holidays. It is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I am Ben Ennis alongside John, Greg, Dave Zarum of Sportsnet Magazine on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Lots to get to on today's show. We'll get to the Raptors, who are in action, resuming their season. Seems like forever ago when they last played. It was on Monday. They are in action, continuing that six-game road trip in L.A. against the Clippers this afternoon in a game you can hear right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Watch on Sportsnet at 3:30. Maple Leafs have to wait until tomorrow. They're in Florida to play the Panthers. 5 points back of the Leafs are the Panthers, headed into that one for the number one wildcard spot. Also, we'll get you set for week 17 in the NFL. But, gents, got to start with Team Canada. I was rocking my Team Canada jersey yesterday, working my double dip, TV and radio. Felt good about it. Never really in doubt.
Does it say Ennis on the back of that jersey?
That's a jersey foul. Greg Wyshynski would tell you that that's a jersey
foul. Yes, he would.
I can't do that. No, it doesn't. Although there's, you know.
It could have been Tyler Ennis.
Yeah, it's kind of been a coup for me the last couple of years that there's actually some Ennises in professional sports now. But they beat Slovakia 8-0. Never close. They scored 3 goals in about 4 minutes and 17 seconds in that first period. And it's not like Slovakia's, Iceland, or like some country where they don't have ice. Like, they only won 5-3 in this preliminary game last year. 8-0 is 8-0, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, I was really impressed with the way they played last night. And Slovakia, I mean, memory serves, that's a team that they had trouble getting past last year.
They trailed into the third period last year.
Yeah, past 2 years, I think.
So there you go. No slouch, no Iceland, like you said. Except, I will say, in the Mighty Ducks D2.
Yeah.
Iceland,
they were pretty good.
Was a powerhouse.
Well, I mean, they have ice in their name. Obviously, they're going to be good.
Exactly. So they're no slouch as themselves. But yeah, I thought Canada was just firing on all cylinders. Obviously, what kind of stuck out to me was how the depth kind of played in to their advantage compared to last year, specifically the fourth line guys like Vertanen who really struggled last time around were key this time around.
Yeah, I mean, this team's built, it's a movement within Hockey Canada itself, right? Where they're building teams based on skill.
What a concept.
But I mean, I think you get too many people who are wrapped up in the NHL and they, you know, Hockey Canada doesn't need to build a team like they're in a salary cap. Mm-hmm. They don't need, you know, top six who are skilled guys and a bottom six who are energy and checkers. Canada's got enough skill to just roll four lines. And I mean, there is a fourth line here that's, you know, with Gauthier and Kraus that, you know, they are big, big kids. And, you know, they are the ones who are supposed to punish you down low. But the rest of that team is loaded with skill. As we saw with Robbie Fabry, he's the third line guy on this team, supposedly.
Yeah, and it is just one game. So you don't want to overreact after 1-8-0 win over Slovakia and probably a little more of the same tonight as they play game number two against Germany.
Germany will be tough. They're a physical team. They play a Canadian style of hockey.
Tougher than Slovakia?
Yes, they will be tougher than Slovakia.
Okay, so I stand corrected. John Grigg predicting an upset. 7-0 win for the Germans tonight, apparently. But I think if you were going to overreact to something, it would be that Canada scored 8 goals against Slovakia and the line of Connor McDavid, Curtis Lazar, and Nick Ritchie had 0 points. It's difficult to do when you're, by everybody's account, I mean, be an absolute shocker. Maybe not a shocker, really, if Jack Eichel went first, but he's going to go top two, is McDavid, and that he didn't end up with a single point in this game, and certainly the foot was a little bit off the gas pedal late in the game. It was done early, if not after the first period, midway through the second, it was pretty much done. Is there anything to be taken away from the fact that McDavid and that line as a whole did not have a single point?
I don't think so. I mean, I think Connor McDavid is still looking a bit rusty, to tell you the truth. I mean, in those pre-tournament games, he had some wide-open chances and couldn't bury. You know, as much as he says he was bag skating while he was off, I mean, it's the hands and the timing and all those kinds of things. And he's now played 2 games, right? So I feel like he'll get it back. Curtis Lazar is a good player. Nick Ritchie is a good player. I think that's a trio that complements each other well. But you could definitely say that through one game of the World Junior Championship, for whatever that's worth, Jack Eichel looks better than Connor McDavid.
And he was really dominant for USA.
Great assist.
Yeah.
Is there, like, are scouts looking at this tournament and really using it as a litmus test when it comes to June, when the NHL entry draft arrives and it is the Edmonton Oilers drafting one again? Are they really going to put much stock into what happens at this tournament? And if we get that, well, we will get the Canada-US in the preliminary round here, that Eichel-McDavid matchup. Is there going to be real tangible stuff that people will use? And that being said, still the caveat of McDavid working his way back to full health, but is there going to be a real takeaway here that might actually affect the draft in this tournament?
You know, I don't know about from the scouts' perspective, because they get to see these guys so often, but certainly for the fan bases of those teams, this is in many instances the first time you get to see these players.
Sure. Especially Jack Eichel. I mean, how often do you get to see Jack Eichel?
Exactly. You just hear these names, you see them on mock drafts, and then this tournament is really when fans get to see them for the first time. So I think it'll definitely sway which direction the fans go in terms of where they want their team to draft come June. But I think you know, as far as the scouts go, they do their homework. This is one tournament. What it does speak to is, you know, in later rounds, how guys perform under pressure situations and things like that. And I think that is pretty valid.
I think what this tournament will give us that you don't always get is, first of all, they're playing on the same side of the board. So they're going to be able to go up head-to-head if the mm-hmm. coaches allow them. That New Year's Eve game is going to be sick. And everybody in the hockey world, whether you're a fan of junior hockey or not, you're going to be watching that game. But also, it's not often that you get the guys who might go one, might go two, nobody's quite sure yet, playing the same position. Usually it's a center or a defenseman or, you know, the big winger or whatever. But here are two, you know, people are saying franchise-altering players who play the same position, and they're going to get a chance to go head-to-head. And, you know, there's been some scuttlebutt recently reported, you know, by Sam Cosentino and Damian Cox that Jack Eichel could end up in the CHL after this tournament. So, I mean, if he plays for St. John or the Quebec Ramparts pick him up or something, and these two guys can meet at the Memorial Cup, I mean, that would be sick. That would be the kind of thing that you just almost never see.
Yeah, you really don't. That would be pretty incredible. Well, if Jack Eichel did win round one over Connor McDavid, I guess Team Canada won round one over the United States. They look like the most impressive of the contenders of this tournament with that 8-0 win. Russia needed a shootout to beat Denmark, who have some pretty skilled players, despite it being Denmark. And the United States needing a shootout to beat Finland, who won last year's tournament as well. So I think on the surface, although Sweden did have a pretty big win over the Czech Republic, a team not expected to compete for the gold medal at this event. But I think overall the takeaway is Canada, out of those contenders, by far impressed more than anybody else.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. But I'd also say that, you know, again, just after one day of this, but I think it's really interesting how good all these teams seem to be, you know, how every team has something going for them. And I think, you know, looking back, the way I remember at least is that there was always some teams you knew were going to get walked over. You think of Denmark, for example, and now they're a competitive team because of their goalie and they got a lot of things going for them. But I think there's a lot of good teams in this tournament. It should make for a nice couple weeks.
There's a lot of Canadian junior hockey players who are in this tournament. You know, yesterday for Denmark, you get Nikolai Ehlers, who plays for the Halifax Mooseheads, and you get Oliver Bjorkstrand, who plays for the Portland Winterhawks.
Don Cherry's not happy about it, but yes.
Well, but these are, you know, these are skilled guys who come over from Europe, and there's no shame in having those guys score against you if you're Russia. You know, they might be the best players on Russia if they played for them. So, you know, that was a close game that actually Russia kind of dominated the possession and all that stuff and outshot them by a healthy margin. But yeah, I would say out of the contenders, Canada looked the best, though they also might have played the worst team. So, you know, let's get a few games in before we can really start grading.
Yeah, it's hard to really, I mean, take too much away from this tournament after one game, obviously. In Switzerland and Germany, the only two teams that haven't played yet, they will get their tournaments underway today. Germany against Canada tonight. But as is always the case headed into this tournament, the bigger question mark surrounding the selection process of the team is the goaltender. Now, we didn't really have that this year because only two were brought to selection.
Well, that's
camp.
Controversial enough, right?
I guess, yeah.
Whatever happened to the idea of competition at the World Junior Camp for goalies?
Sure. And Zach Fucali, the incumbent, was given the job in game one, did nothing, obviously, didn't allow a goal, did nothing to lose that job, although Eric Comrie's going to get the start tonight against Germany, which makes sense. You want to split the first two games. Is there any way that Comrie can take over the lead dog role with a good performance against Germany? I guess it's just, you know, you use the preliminary round to really figure things out, right? Because it's almost impossible to not make the knockout round, especially now that you have a win. There's only one team that gets eliminated from the preliminary round. So it's as much as they already played exhibition games, these are still basically, even the New Year's Eve game against the United States, not a whole lot is at stake here, right?
Well, there's bragging rights and there's seeding. I mean, seeding is important as well.
Yeah.
You want to finish first in your division and you want to roll over everybody so that the next time you play them in the medal round, they've been rolled over.
Yeah. And you want to get your scorers, you know, first couple of goals. Robbie Fabry, I'm sure, is feeling pretty good after his 4-point night yesterday against Slovakia. Should we take anything away that it was kind of a disappointing crowd at the Bell Center yesterday, just over 14,000 on hand? They were hoping for a sellout. It is Slovakia. I mean, they're going to sell out that game against the United States, and then all the knockout games with Canada are going to be sold out when they're back here in Toronto as well. Is there anything to be taken away from the fact that it was only 14,000? Again, though, it is junior hockey. 14,000 on the surface would think be pretty good, but this tournament in Canada, we expect it to sell out almost instantaneously, and it didn't yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be too concerned about that. I thought the crowd that was there was really active into that game. Canada obviously gave them a lot to cheer for. Part of it maybe, too, is, you know, like we're talking about, these first few games are fairly inconsequential, and maybe people have gotten used to the fact that in these types of tournaments, especially against weaker teams, there's not too much at stake for the first few games. So maybe that's part of it.
I think you know, we're used to it here in Toronto where they say junior hockey doesn't sell and this is a big time city for big time sports fans or however you want to say it. But I think there is something to be worried about when Canada can't sell out the Bell Center. It's a holiday game. It's a Boxing Day tradition. It's I think, you know, I don't know that junior hockey sells in big markets in this city or in this country, sorry, like we think it should. And, you know, if you're in Saskatoon or you're hosting this in Red Deer, obviously the arenas are smaller, but, you know, people are going crazy for it. And that just doesn't happen, you know, or at least hasn't happened in this tournament yet. And it'll be interesting to see how tickets go before the medal round in general.
So where do you think that that responsibility lies to make people kind of...
I don't know. I mean, is maybe Montreal is just a Habs town, just like this is a Leafs town.
Oh, you're ripping Montreal now, are you,
No,
John?
I'm not saying that. I mean, what's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with it necessarily, but, you know.
Well, people think there's something wrong with Toronto that it's just a Leaf town and not a hockey town. I think people really, you know, they like to take jabs at Toronto for being just a Maple Leafs town and that nobody really pays attention to the rest of the National Hockey League or junior hockey or the Marlies or anything in this city outside of the Toronto Maple Leafs. I mean, what you're saying might be fair, but I think it's a common, you know, barb thrown at hockey fans, quote unquote, in Toronto. And you're saying maybe it's the same deal in Montreal.
Well, I mean, I don't know that it is per se, but I mean, obviously yesterday was an example of that very fact, right? I mean, it's still Team Canada and it's still Boxing Day.
Sure.
Nobody had to work yesterday.
You got to go shopping, though.
Well, sure.
My goodness.
I mean, the game was at 8 o'clock.
You don't do that. You don't go shopping on the 26th, do you? Real sadist to do that.
You see the line outside of, where is it, Yorkdale?
No, I heard about it. It was horrible, though.
Heading all the way onto the 401 as they were parked on there.
That's enough. Man, yeah. I'll stay away. Thank you very much. I'm
speechless.
Good.
Ben Ennis is speechless.
Yeah,
people.
Wow. You can't get me into a mall on a good day, certainly not on the 26th. What about the fact that it's not been a great run the last 5 years of this tournament for Canada, right? Like they haven't won since 2009, didn't even finish in the medals the last couple of years. Does that play into, you know, a little bit of the shine being worn off this team and this tournament as a whole? And when you're looking for a reason that there was only 14,000 at the game yesterday, could that be a reason as well? Or is it kind of make the tournament, I mean, there's the other side of it. Maybe it makes the tournament more interesting because you're not expecting Canada to go romping to the gold medal in this event.
Yeah, I think if you're a fan of the World Junior Championship, then yes, it definitely makes the tournament more interesting. If you're a fan of, you know, Canada's World Junior entry, then no, it doesn't. But I mean, it's also kind of boring when you know you win five gold in a row and you just you walk over everybody. Granted, it's great for flag waving, and you'd rather have them win gold than finish fourth. But it is nice to see some competition, and it is nice to know that you can't just roll in there every year and expect a gold or a silver.
I mean, I think there's no question about that. And regardless of last night, the 8-0 win, you know, I think just as a sports fan in general, you want to see close games. I want to see close games more than anything else. Whether it's a team I'm cheering for or not, I don't want to see any blowouts. I want to see tied with 30 seconds left. I want to see who comes up in those moments. I think that's kind of when sports are at its best. So to see that kind of, it's not parity in this tournament, but close to it or closer to it than we've seen in a long time. I think that's something that should draw fans in.
And when you think of the most recent great memories for Canadians from the WJC, it's Jordan Eberle scoring with like 5 seconds to
exactly.
play.
It's Russia.
It's Jonathan Tay scoring 3 or 4 times in a shootout, right? Preach. I mean, those are the close games that everybody remembers. And I mean, you watched that U.S. Czech game yesterday, and it was 2-1, went to a shootout. Jack Eichel had a goal in the shootout and an assist in the regulation.
Finland almost scored in the dying seconds of regulation as well.
Those are the games you want to see. I mean, 8-0 is great. It's a nice start. You like to rack up goals because you need them. But you, as far as entertainment value, there's only one way to go when you ask which of those games was more entertaining yesterday.
Also, doesn't a win mean more when it comes with 5 seconds left or in overtime?
It certainly sticks more in your head, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Like that final against Russia in 2011 in Buffalo. That third period will stick in my mind. That'll be one of the lasting memories, in my opinion, of this tournament. You're listening to Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis, alongside Dave Zarum and John Grigg. Is Canada beating Slovakia 8-0 in Montreal yesterday at their opener at the World Junior Hockey Championships. Mentioned the other teams as well. The U.S. beating Finland 2-1 in a shootout. Jack Eichel had that nice backhand assist for the only goal in regulation. They end up winning in a shootout. Russia beat Denmark 3-2 in a shootout. Again, they did control the play. And the Danes, you like to rip them because who knows of Denmark as a hockey powerhouse. But as you mentioned, John, there's a bunch of players on that team that play in the CHL, and they're pretty good. Sweden also hammered the Czech Republic 5-2. And William Nylander scored. He's a guy that, of course, is going to draw the eyeballs from this city, Toronto, being a Maple Leafs first-round pick, top 10. And the fact that he scored, I guess, is good. I mean, it'll be interesting to see him match up against Eichel or McDavid. He's on the other side. They're in the other division, so it'll have to come in the knockout stage. But it'll be interesting to see how far removed from those guys he is. A little bit older than both of them, obviously. Those guys are just draft eligible. He's already been drafted, but it'll be interesting to see him go head-to-head against Eichel or McDavid.
Yeah, he was looking pretty sick yesterday. If you're a Leafs fan, you can get pretty pumped up about this kid. I mean, I think he's the second highest drafted player in the tournament behind Canada's own Reinhardt, and he controls play. He's got he can go from 0 to 60 in like 2 steps. He's got sweet hands. He's making beauty passes yesterday. He's a, power play demon.
And he's been playing with men in the KHL. So, yes, as Connor McDavid dominates the CHL, at least when he was playing and healthy as a 17-year-old, and Jack Eichel, NCAA hockey. I guess you got older kids playing NCAA hockey, but I don't know if it compares against professionals in the KHL who are making now half as
Swedish,
much as they did
SHL.
SHL. I don't know if it compares necessarily to what William Nylander had to play against and with this season. We've seen him take a couple of hard knocks as well, even in yesterday's game, but he suffered a concussion playing in Sweden this season as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's playing against men, and anytime you can be amongst the league leaders when you're 18 years old and you're amongst the league leaders in scoring in a man's league, then you're doing well for yourself. Now, I think Connor McDavid and Jack Eichel, specifically Eichel, would dominate that league as well. They are already that good, even though they're a year younger or so. But yeah, the fact that he, it might be nice to see him play for the Marlies, actually, but the fact that he's not playing for the Mississauga Steelheads in junior, he's back playing against men, playing in a pro league, I think is super important to his development. And I think you're seeing some of that, or you saw some of it yesterday.
And I think if you're a Leaf fan, it's going to be particularly exciting to see throughout this tournament this guy, because I mean, just when's the last time the Leafs have had a draft pick that you can be excited about? You know, a promising draft pick like Nylander is showing himself to be to this point.
Yeah, he's been very good, and people in this city are pretty excited to go check him out, which you can do down at the Air Canada Centre, because that is the division that is playing down there.
And the fact that they didn't rush him, you know, they didn't pull a Morgan Riley, right?
Edmonton Oilers him. Edmonton Oilers would have had him playing game one at the Air Canada Centre.
Yeah, I mean, we don't need to spend too much more time piling on the Oilers on this show and on every show, it seems like. But
why not?
But, you know, we're talking about Germany versus Canada. You know, wouldn't Leon Draisaitl look great playing for Germany and getting a chance to play against his peers? Look, why don't you send that kid to the World Juniors? I don't get that at all. He's just getting smoked out there playing for the Oilers. And, I mean, obviously the team is brutal. The attitude around the team is brutal. And here's a kid who could go and could help his country and could be, you know, he could dominate as well. He would be right there with the Eichels and McDavids in terms of top-level skill.
Yeah, it is interesting, right? It seems like there are certain guys who can adapt immediately to the higher level, where you've got the teams like the Detroit Red Wings who really let their players develop in the AHL for a long time before calling them up, and that seems to work pretty well. One last thing before we wrap up our junior talk. I love the fact that this tournament actually gets it right as far as points, where overtime and shootout wins are not worth the same as regulation. I'm okay with overtime wins being worth the same amount as regulation, but it's 3 points for regulation win, and you get two for shootout win or whatever, and one for shootout loss. This is exactly what the NHL should do. Come on, somebody jump on board here with me. No?
I can't do it.
What's wrong with
you? Why does anybody deserve anything for losing? That's my question.
Well, because a shootout is not a hockey thing. It's like a skills freak show at the end of a game. You should not be rewarded for being the best at the freak show skills competition.
Well, it happens in soccer as well. I mean, and that's the biggest sport in the world. I mean, I don't know. I just feel like there shouldn't be a loser point. Loser points are, you know, they're for losers.
It's been happening. It's been institutionalized in soccer forever. I mean, that's always, and in soccer, you can't play forever as well, right? Like, imagine you had guys playing for 5 hours in a championship soccer game. It's just not going to happen. I just hate the fact that, like, look at the Detroit Red Wings, who have, what, a million shootout losses, and every year they have a million shootout losses. They have, seven shootout losses. They are 1-7 in the shootout again this season. There's 7 points that are out the window because of this freak skills competition, because they haven't drafted well. They haven't drafted players that can put the puck in one-on-one.
And Zetterberg and Nyquist. And,
apparently,
you know,
they stink of the shootout.
Maybe the goaltending is the issue there, but, I mean,
every year they stink of the shootout.
You can't say that they haven't drafted well and they don't have skilled guys who can score.
All right, I'm surprised nobody else was with me on that. Okay.
Next time.
Yeah, maybe. when we come back, Raptors continue their road trip this afternoon, 3:30 Eastern time. A little early affair in L.A. against the Clippers. The six-game roadie did not start all that well. 0-1 after that loss to the Bulls on Monday.
The sky is falling.
It's all over. They're just an Eastern Conference. They're a good team in the Eastern Conference. They stink against any Western Conference opponent. I don't know if that's necessarily true, but we'll talk about how true it might be. And Bruno Caboclo, grab your Mad Ants jersey. He's headed to Fort Wayne, wherever that is. We'll figure that out coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis, along with John Grigg and Dave Zarum on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Gare Joyce.
It was the best of stories and the worst of stories. Not a tale of two cities, but six. Prince Albert, Saskatoon, Moose Jaw, Brandon, Regina, and Swift Current. Okay, enough. If you spent 2 weeks on a bus with a bunch of teenage hockey players, you'd be punchy too. A few weeks back, I boarded the Seattle Thunderbirds bus for the worst road trip in sports, going from the Pacific rainforest into the teeth of prairie winter. I lived, barely, to tell the story in this issue of Sportsnet magazine. Everyone in hockey knows the travel in the Western Hockey League is a bear. And everyone in the dub will tell you that the worst of the travel is the Eastern Conference road swing. Sask and Brandon, that the teams in the Pacific have to make. A road trip so bad that teams only have to make it every 2 years. I knew all this going in, and it was still worse than I ever imagined it. What else can you say about 60 hours on a bus? Or riding for hours after a game when the heater conks out and temperatures outside are minus 24. I've spent a couple of decades covering junior hockey, and I thought I knew all about the lives of players in the CHL. But after the worst roadie, I have a whole new appreciation of the challenges these kids face, and a sinking feeling every time I see a bus pass me on the street.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet magazine, available on newsstands now, and for your tablet and mobile phone on Next Issue and in the Apple newsstand.
I feel like jumping in my truck. Is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Annis alongside Dave Zarum and John Grigg. Raptors back in action, first time since losing to the Bulls on Monday, giving up 49 points in that fourth quarter. They had a long holiday Christmas break. Clippers, not so much. They played on Christmas Day against the Warriors and picked up their biggest win of the season, beating the Warriors, but they are in action at Staples Center this afternoon, 3:30 Eastern time on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. All right, so the Raptors 0-1 on this six-game roadie, started in Chicago, 129-120 loss to the Bulls on Monday, got the Clippers this afternoon, tomorrow in Denver, Tuesday in Portland, Friday Golden State, Sunday it wraps up in Phoenix. All right, Dave, what is the expectation on this road trip? What is acceptable? What is the dividing line between success and failure on this six-game road trip?
Well, I think when you look at the strengths of some of the teams they're facing, the Clippers, you mentioned the Blazers, the Warriors, those are three really good teams. The other two teams they're facing, Denver and Phoenix, are not quite in that category, to say the least. For me, I think if the Raptors walk away with three wins on this trip, I think that's A, realistic, and B, would be considered a successful trip.
I think that would be more than successful. I would be almost blown away if they win three out of their next five against those teams on the road, and you got Denver on the back end of back-to-backs after playing a Clippers team. I think three is almost unrealistic to expect that from this team.
But, I mean, this is what we've been talking about with the Raptors for the past 2 weeks, it feels like, ever since that Cleveland loss, is how are they going to fare against the top Western teams? They're obviously the class of the East, save for Chicago and maybe Washington.
Although they've beaten Washington this year, beat the Hawks twice already, beat Memphis at home as well, although they were missing five guys because they had the flu.
But so we've been looking forward to this West trip for a long time because these are teams that are on paper probably better than the Raptors. So it's a question of, you know, how will the Raptors play up to their opponent, or will they play like they've been playing against these crappy teams in the East, you know? And that's why I think it's so interesting the next five games. But I'm pretty optimistic. I mean, this team's playing well, fourth quarter of Monday's game against Chicago, excluding. But yeah, I think, you know, you have to look at the Denver game as a win. Yeah, it's a back to back in the high altitude, but that's just not a very good team. Phoenix, I think, is a team that the Raptors match up well against and should also walk away with the win.
They've beaten them already once this year,
and same with Denver as well. So I think that lines up the Clippers, Blazers, and Warriors. And of those three games, to win one game
this afternoon,
I don't think it's unrealistic
today, right? I mean, if you're lining up, if you're the Raptors with their, you know, with that bench strength, I mean, yeah, you don't probably have the pure power scorer like Blake, but you know, Lowry and Chris Paul. I mean, that's a wash, right?
Pretty close to it.
Yeah, I mean, Lowry's been the MVP in the East.
Yeah, I mean, if the Raptors don't win that one, it's a wash.
John Wall's been pretty good in the East.
Yeah, I think those two guys have been, like, neck to neck. I mean, the Raptors have a better record against worse opponents. But, yeah, those two are in the same class right now.
Yeah, and today you could almost understand if the Clippers, after riding high after that Christmas Day win over the Warriors, maybe had a bit of a step back, and they haven't had the time off that the Raptors have had. That being said, maybe the Raptors are a little rusty. Who knows?
Yeah. So, Dave, break it down for me, though. I mean, in my mind, the key to this team is that depth. That they basically have two units, and they are the envy of the league when it comes to that kind of depth. So, for me, if I'm Casey, I'm running at people all day long. I'm playing relentless D. I'm subbing guys in and out, you know, all the time, just making sure you got fresh legs. And that's how you take it to these other teams that are kind of star heavy, top of the lineup, Western Conference powerhouses, right?
Yeah, I mean, no question that that's what they've been doing, and that's what I would assume Casey will continue to look to do. But the other thing that the depth provides them is matchup options. You know, they can play, Casey can play chess with more pieces, if you want to put it that way. I mean, it allows you to look at your opponent and put out a lineup that's going to be able to exploit them, as opposed to having to rely on your five guys or whatever, like a lot of teams will. Today's game against the Clippers is interesting because they're another team with a lot of depth, and they roll 8-10 deep as well. So, I mean, that should be a really cool matchup because of that.
I don't know if I'm fully on board with the way that Jonas Valanciunas has been deployed. He had a great start offensively, and it seems like almost every game they try to get him that first offensive touch down low to see what he's got on a given night. Mm-hmm. And if he misses that thing, it's done. He doesn't get another touch for like 5 minutes or until he subs out there, that first substitution in the first quarter. But on Monday against the Bulls, I mean, he was taking it to Powell. He was relentless.
He was like Hakeem Olajuwon.
Right. I mean, he had the sky hook working, and everything he threw up there went down. They went away from it. It was not something that they continued to revisit it. And you know, I guess part of it is matchups, but how do you feel he's been deployed this year?
Well, you know, I think it goes back to what Greg was saying with the depth. I mean, when you can have a guy like Patrick Patterson come off the bench and provide you an entirely different look than Valanciunas gives you, that's something that Casey's shown that he wants to utilize. You know, he's been playing Chuck Hayes and Tyler Hansbrough, maybe more than we all expected. So someone's got to sit, and it's been Valanciunas lately. I think Casey's going to continue to roll with matchups. And it brings up that question of, you know, what's more important, developing your young center or winning basketball games? And where the Raptors are right now, especially when you look around the East and the rest of the NBA, the priority is winning basketball games. So whatever they need to do to accomplish that is the top priority. And if it means benching Valanciunas for the fourth, so be it. It's frustrating to watch sometimes because, like you said, on Monday, you see him early on against Pau Gasol and Joakim Noah, who are no slouches at that position, you know?
Yep.
And he's just having his way with them. And you think, why can't this be what it's like every game? But it's just the reality of the situation right now.
And the numbers, I mean, his numbers are encouraging this year as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, his per game numbers are pretty much static, but I mean, he's playing fewer minutes. His mm-hmm. per 36 minute stats are up across the board from last year. So he is developing. I mean, and he needs to be a beast down low for this team, I think, to be successful in terms of making any kind of a playoff run. You've got to have that guy who can guard the rim and also just pound people down on the block.
And that is an interesting point. You wonder, when we look ahead to the playoffs, if they're going to ramp up his minutes heading into those games, because he's going to be that much more important when the games slow down, when teams kind of play a style that's more friendly for his game.
Right, and you don't want him to be playing his first crunch time minutes in the playoffs, right? At some point, you'd like to see him get in there. Plus, this team has had its issues rebounding at times, and he's probably their best rebounder as well.
Yeah, no question. Him or maybe Amir, he's a really situational rebounder.
Amir, I feel like,
rebounder.
Has had a bit of a down year this year.
Yeah, you wonder how much the ankle thing is coming into effect. Also, I think they're looking even now at resting him for the playoffs as well. But part of the, you know, the closing out games in the fourth quarter thing is, when you look at the Raptors, I think they're first or they're second in the league in point differential. So they haven't been playing too many close games that are going down to the wire. So as you know, the last 5 minutes of a game comes around and it looks like the Raptors have a win in tow, Casey has an excuse to sit this guy down. And I think it all makes for an intriguing kind of second half for this guy.
And is that where this team, if it needs help, I mean, they're not going to pull off any kind of massive move, I don't think, and move any of the guys, the pieces they already have in place. But that's probably where they need the help the most, if you're going to make any moves, right, is rebounding and another big body down low to crash and bang in the playoffs.
Isn't everybody looking for that rim protector, though?
I think so. I think that's kind of where the NBA is right now. And it's part of why you see Valanciunas and think, like, he needs to be out there, because there's so few big traditional centers like that who control the boards, control the basket on both ends of the floor.
The Cavs would love one.
Yeah. Anderson Varejao out there, they're so bereft of size at this point. So it is a luxury, you know, and it's one you want to see the Raptors utilize more and more.
Where do the Cavs fit in, though? I mean, for me, it's like, you know, with Love and LeBron and Kyrie Irving, nobody can boast that kind of a threesome in the East. I mean,
and it was kind of telling that Love was benched late in the fourth quarter against the Magic yesterday in a game that they had to come back to win. And a big reason why is they started getting some defense out of that position.
I don't know. I'm worried about Cleveland. I mean, we saw them struggle at the very beginning of the season and figured, okay, you know, it takes time. And I think that's still part of the excuse, for lack of a better word, out there. But I think by this point, by the new year, I thought they would have had it together by now. And they're out of sync. I mean, LeBron's playing a little more below the rim than we've seen him play in the past, maybe less assertive, if you want to put it that way. That's certainly concerning to see. Kyrie Irving is a guy who's never been in a position in his life to play meaningful basketball games, and now he is being relied on to do that. He's also a guy who's dominated the ball his whole life, and now it looks like the Cavs are better when he's playing off the ball with LeBron having the rock in his hands. And yeah, Love looks out of sync. Like you said, they benched him against Miami. So I'm not too optimistic about Cleveland this year. When I look at, from the Raptors' perspective, coming back to Toronto, when I look around the East, yes, they're a dangerous team. In a playoff series, they are still going to be hard to get by because of LeBron. But I look at teams like Chicago as the real threats, and I think Cleveland still has to get their act together.
And certainly this regular season has played that out with the Raptors having their issues with the Chicago Bulls. They've beaten Washington already, beat the Hawks twice as well. Hawks were playing maybe the best basketball in the NBA before getting annihilated by Jason Kidd's Bucks yesterday, 30 points, 107-77 in Atlanta. Got to give some credit to Jason Kidd. He's got Bucks at 500 at 15-15 for one of the worst teams in the NBA last year.
And that's a team that has every excuse to kind of fold, you know, Jabari Parker out for the season is a huge blow. He looked so promising early on. But yeah, they're an interesting team. They're deep, not with star talent, but they go deep as well on their roster. Guys like Antetokounmpo are really exciting
nice,
to watch.
Nice.
I had to try. I'm not sure if I got it, but I had to try. And there's just a lot of interesting players on that team, and they're certainly defying expectations.
Back to the Raptors for a second here. So they continued the road trip today in LA against the Clippers, and mentioned how difficult it'll be. And I think two wins you'd be pretty satisfied with in the next five games. But I still feel like the theme of this season for Raptors fans is trying to gain legitimacy, right? Like, you look at that first TNT Thursday night game against the Bulls. Look at us. We're a real basketball team. We're a team that can compete for the number one seed in the Eastern Conference, for an Eastern Conference championship. This is us. And they look at the rest of the NBA world and looking at the Raptors and saying, well, that's a good Eastern Conference team, but you put them in the West and probably not even in the playoffs. So I think that's still a theme
for Raptor fans. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Well,
they're going to make the playoffs if they're in the West, at least.
Well, you look at it's you're going to have to be over 500. I think last year the eighth place team had 50 wins in the Western Conference.
Phoenix, I think, had 49 or something. They missed.
Phoenix currently in that eighth spot in the West at 17-14. So, and again, you'd have to be playing those Western Conference teams every single day, seemingly.
So if we think that, you know, Ben, you're saying two wins, Dave, you're saying three wins. So that means we don't think this is a legitimate title contending team, right? If they can't go
the
on
Raptors?
A six game. Yeah. If they can't go on a six game trip through the West and playing two, what we think are gimme games, and maybe not win more than those two.
Have we ever thought that they were a title contender?
I don't think we've ever gone that far with the Raptors. I think there's only one team in the East that you could say has a chance to win the title, and they have to be 1,000% healthy to do it. And that's Chicago.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone has a chance.
All right.
But are they legit Eastern Conference champion? Can you say that you can put the Raptors in a conversation with, you know, one or two other teams as being the best teams in the Eastern Conference and could go to an NBA Finals, which is insane to be talking about when you look at where this team was 12 months ago.
But it's a testament to how they've been playing and how all these pieces have been coming together. I think, you know, can they make it to the Finals? It would take an incredible run of basketball, obviously. But I wouldn't be surprised if they finished the regular season atop the East if they stayed where they are right now. I mean, there's a lot going for them. And when you look at being able to withstand something like an injury to DeMar DeRozan.
Which has been incredible. I can't believe that the run that they've gone on without DeMar.
What are they, 9-3, 10-3?
Yeah.
I thought for sure this team, I didn't think they were going to collapse, but I figured they'd be 500.
500, yeah.
Yeah, because he's a huge part of it. And also, you know, obviously, you know, he gets to the line, which is huge late in games. He's your go-to scorer, so he's important from that end. But I think we're also seeing now, and it's something, Ben, you were talking about off air a little bit, is that, you know, DeRozan's defense was important for the team too. And it's an area where he's, you know, we make a big deal about how much better he gets every year, but we don't talk enough about how much better he gets defensively as well.
Sure.
And so when you have to replace DeRozan's defense with someone like Lou Williams or Vasquez, you know, I think that's really telling too. And like you're saying, they've been able to weather that storm, and it just kind of goes to the depth and just how well everyone's playing together on the same page.
Also should mention Bruno Caboclo headed to the Fort Wayne Mad Ants of the NBA DL. He will play in Iowa today, and I think more people are going to be paying attention to this Mad Ants box score than maybe any time in history. There's like 12 different NBA teams that are affiliated with this franchise, the Mad Ants. I don't know if you can watch it online. You must be able to, or maybe they're not even televised. I don't know. But you'll be able to look at the box score afterwards. I guess, David, it makes sense to get him some reps. You just want to see him develop. And I guess part of the season and the reason he stayed with the Raptors so long was just getting him acclimatized.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's frustrating because on one end, it's going to be really, it was really fun to see the fans do the We Want Bruno and him kind of
the human victory cigar.
The human victory cigar, this 19-year-old Brazilian kid. It was just kind of a, who shot the ball every time he touched it in the minute he was on the court.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was fun to see. There's, you know, another element to home games at least. But yeah, this is definitely a good thing for his basketball development. You need to play to get better, and I don't think he was doing that here.
The D League's not the best place to go for development, though.
It's better, right? Better than nothing, though.
Yeah, I guess that's my question. Are you better off practicing every day hard against like legit NBA players, or jacking up, you know, 20 shots a game in the D League and playing no defense?
You know, I think once the season starts, there really aren't those practice opportunities that we think there are on a day to day basis. So I don't really think you get in the gym that often. In the D League, you know, the Raptors and Casey's staff are going to be in talks every day with the coaching staff down there to make sure they're making him play defense and do things that they're going to be asking for when he comes back. And, you know, there's been a lot of success stories from the D League. James Johnson is one of them.
Yep.
So I think it's certainly a good thing for Bruno.
He will be playing alongside Toronto's own Mike Kabongo's on that team. Mm-hmm. You got Glenn Rice Jr. is on that team, and CJ Fair. So there's some guys you can actually recognize on that Mad Ants roster. Got to get myself a jersey. When we come back, Maple Leafs next in action tomorrow. Yes, it's a Saturday night. They do not play tonight, but they will play tomorrow afternoon against the Panthers in Florida. We'll talk about what's gone on with the Leafs this season, because it seems pretty leafy so far. Seems like we've seen this script before, and a year ago it didn't work out all that well. Is there reason that this team will not fall into that same trap? We'll find out next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside John Gregg and Dave Zarum on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
The top topics, the headiest headlines, the debatiest debate. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside John Gregg and Dave Zarum. Maple Leafs getting a lot of Sunday action in this season. It continues tomorrow. They do not play tonight on Hockey Night in Canada, but in Florida tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock on Sportsnet against the Panthers. Panthers 5 points back of the Maple Leafs. They ended that three-game losing streak with a win on Festivus 4-0 over the Stars. And they did it in, of course, Leafian fashion, giving up 40-plus shots on goal, 43. Jonathan Bernier stopped them all, like he's done quite often this season. Well, not stopping them all, but stopping plenty of them. Maple Leafs are doing exactly what they did a year ago. And I had Steve Birch on this radio program a week ago, statsman for sportsnet.ca. And I posited to him, if you had a team that was top three in PDO and bottom three in Corsi percentage four, wouldn't that spell a recipe for absolute unmitigated disaster for the rest of the season? He said, yeah, pretty much. That's where the Maple Leafs find themselves, John. They are 20-12-3. They were very similar position-wise last year, where they were top wild card spot. They might have even been in the top three in their division headed to that road swing in L.A. and Anaheim and San Jose. That's coming up January 12th. They go to L.A. to play the Kings. But they were doing the same thing. They were getting outshot by an absolute ton. People said it wouldn't last. People made fun of the Corsi Hockey League. And the chickens came home to roost. Why won't they this year?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I can say that they won't.
Right.
But, I mean, this is a better team than it was last year. I mean, it's deeper. You know, everybody talks about the tomato cans who aren't on this team and whatnot. And
so why are they still allowing the shot totals then?
Well, I mean, it's I mean, the one part is your best players have to buy into not allowing shots against. And that's not really the way that the top six on this team performs, or at least the top three. Phil Kessel will never be known for his defensive prowess. And, you know, and he's not paid to be defensive either. Let's make that clear. I mean, you need him scoring 90 points and 40 goals, and that's where he makes his hay. But there is something to be said for back-checking and playing defense and playing hard for every minute that you're on the ice and not floating. And that's, you know, it's a problem for this team in the fact that, you know, you've got to play those guys 20 minutes a game to be successful. And if they're not playing the 200-foot game, then you're going to give up a lot of shots. They also have a fairly crappy defense corps. And, you know, who can't really move the puck as well as you'd like and who seem to lose a lot of one-on-one battles.
Yeah, it just seems like, and I agree with you, like this team a year ago had three lines and then there was some guys that were nominally on the fourth line. It just, you could not play it in any meaningful fashion. So I would look at this team and say, yeah, it has to be improved. And sure, they have a nice record and they've scored the most goals in all the National Hockey League and all that. But you would think if you are better than a year ago and you've learned the lessons of a year ago and everybody's saying the right things, and we hear Randy Carlyle postgame and we hear Dave Nonis talk about the fact that, well, we know this type of play is not sustainable in the long term, why can't it translate to anything tangible? Why aren't we seeing the shot totals go down? Why are we continuing to see these epic shot totals against Jonathan Bernier? And maybe part of it is score effects. Sure, we'll give you that in a 4-0 loss to the, or a win over the Dallas Stars. But certainly, you know, you've learned something with the way the wheels completely fell off the train a year ago. Why can't you translate that to the ice? Is there a problem with the message that's being sent from the head coach? That's, I guess, what I'm asking.
I think it goes back to what Greg's saying with the personnel. I mean, I think heading into this year's trade deadline, if the Leafs aren't players, at least, then I think the fans should be rioting, regardless of the team's good record, because these are the same problems we saw last year. I think it's safe to say not enough was done in the offseason to address that. Like Robidoux, Roman Pollock, that's not gonna solve anything. And you know, again, to Grigg's point with the top six and their kind of lack of defensive responsibility, I think when you look at the top 20 scorers in the NHL, of which both Kessel and Van Riemsdyk are members of that club, I think those are the only two guys. There might be one other person. I think Stamkos is minus one. But Kessel and Van Riemsdyk, those are the only top 20 scorers who have a negative plus minus. And it kind of goes to the root of this team's problem, which is kind of an overall lack of commitment to stopping shots and defense.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to do it 5-on-5, right? And I mean,
they've been good on the power play.
Yeah,
well, and penalty kill.
Yeah. But Bozak, I mean, does he have a goal that's not on the power play this year?
Yeah, I'm not sure. But I wouldn't put much of the blame on Tyler Bozak either. I mean, I think he does his job to the best of his abilities, and
the numbers people would.
Well, yeah, but I mean, he takes a lot of draws in the defensive zone. He might play on the top line, but he has a lot of responsibility on that team. And yeah, I mean, you know, the numbers people will say Nazem Kadri is the most improved player in the league and the best Maple Leaf when it comes to all around play and driving possession. And that may be true, but, you know, for my money, you know, Bozak is also a guy who, he might be a little bit miscast as a number one, but he is a valuable, valuable tool for this team.
Yeah, and certainly, oh, he's great in the shootout as well. Don't forget about that. I think the Detroit Red Wings would like to have Tyler Bozak on their team for shootouts alone. And yeah, winning draws, he's been great. And on the power play, he's been great at racking up the points. But it just doesn't seem like this team has a line that will cycle the puck. And yeah, you want the puck going at the net eventually, and you can't win if you just keep it in the offensive corner all game. But that's part of defense as well, is not having to play it. And this team, maybe the Kadri line at times has been that line with Santarelli and Winnick, who's been kind of a revelation as far as a possession. It's not going to rack up many points or any really at all for the number of minutes he plays or with the type of players he plays with. But it just doesn't seem like this team has that line that will maintain the possession, right? Like we've talked about this. This was a year ago as well. They're a line rush team. They come through the neutral zone, maybe with speed, over the line with speed, get one shot, rebound, puck's headed the other way. And that seems like a system thing to me.
And that might be a way to compete during the regular season, but I think come playoff time, you know, we've seen that that doesn't get the job done. I mean, there needs to be, I think, fundamental changes in either the personnel or the way this team plays, and I don't know if I see that on the horizon.
And can you get by? I mean, yes, injuries are fluke things, but it's also, having a workload like Jonathan Bernier has had can't be all that great for a guy who hasn't played a full season in his career as the number one either.
I don't know. I think that if you're the number one goalie on an NHL hockey team, you want to play every single day.
Right.
And you don't want that kind of am I or aren't I kind of thing. You want to know that it's your puck, it's your crease, right?
Well, and the question has been resolved, don't you think? He is the 100%,
1A. Yeah. I think the last time I was on this show, I said, come on, guys, let's make a decision. And then you pointed out to me that he had started 8 of the past 10 games
yeah.
and kind of put me in my place. And then, but since then, I think, Reimer might have, two or three starts. I mean, Bernier is for sure the number one and deservedly so.
Yeah, he has been spectacular. Again, though, he's never stayed healthy for an entire season as the number one.
Yeah, but you can't be scared
really
of health,
one shot
right?
At that.
Yeah, and you can't be scared of that. You've got to go with the guy who got you there. And, if he gets hurt and becomes kind of one of these brittle players who is always a disappointment because he's always bothered by nagging injuries, well, then that's another issue. But you don't worry about it. You let him go.
All right. So if the Maple Leafs do the Colorado Avalanche thing this year, where they are able to sustain this for an entire season, get into the playoffs despite being outshot by a 2-1 margin on the season, and say they go out in the first round or they make it into the second round, get knocked out. I mean, is Randy Carlyle back? Because I want to point to something. I want to understand why the shot totals keep happening. I also want to understand this, which is interesting to me. Maple Leafs 5-7-1 against teams who are under 500 this season. That's lousy. They're 15-5-2 against teams above 500. That's good, I guess, but how can you have a motivation problem? Because that's what it seems to be, right? And we've seen it. They go into Buffalo against a brutal Sabres team. Now, the Sabres might not be as brutal as they appeared to be at the time, but you get outplayed. You get outplayed by the Buffalo freaking Sabres. You go into Carolina in a game everybody called a trap game. Everybody knew it was a trap game. You come out with a lousy effort. You come up with a lousy effort against the Flyers. You lose to those teams. Isn't motivation part of that? And if you were going to point to a few things that a head coach can affect, wouldn't motivation be one of those things?
Well, I mean, do you think it's a motivation thing, or maybe it speaks to the character of the guys in the locker room? I mean, I'm not going to question their effort, but maybe they're guys who will look at a game and say, maybe I don't need to bring it all tonight, or whatever the case may be. And maybe there's more than one of those guys on this team, and so it's a systematic problem that goes kind of deep in the roots.
Well, and we hear post game after these games, we got outworked. We didn't come with the effort today. Mm-hmm. Like that's a common refrain you hear after those Hurricanes games, after the Sabres games. I just don't get it.
And does that, I mean, I don't know. I question how much the coach has to do with that. I mean, that has to come from yourself. You got to have pride at some point, right?
So what does the coach do outside of putting the lines out there and matching up guys? I mean, isn't there a secondary component to this? I mean, I get into this conversation with people about baseball all the time.
I was like, just going to say, yeah.
Does Joe Madden's, fancy, bringing in witch doctors and whatever, does that help a team that he's such a, cheery dude? Like, I don't know. There's something to that?
At this point, they're grown men, aren't they? They're professionals. I mean, you have to bring it upon yourself to at least show up and try your hardest, or you'd hope at least. I think I look at coaches doing things more like we talked about before, putting in systems, like you talk about rolling out lines, who starts that night, things like that. I mean, in terms of effort, that has to come from the players.
Yeah, I think we all know who Randy Carlyle is, and he's not the guy who shows up in the dressing room before games and pats you on the back and gives you the rah-rah, win one for the Gipper type speech. I mean, that's just not his style. We saw that last year on the road to the Winter Classic, the contrasting, the difference between him and Mike Babcock and the way that they run pregame meetings and everything. I mean, it's night and day. But I do think that there's something to be said for if your team is continually scored upon first and comes out, slow-footed and looking lousy, it's time to raise some hell and do something important that will, that could maybe address it. And, earlier this season, he was benching Morgan Riley and Jake Gardner. And, I, for one, was saying, well, if you want to make a real decision or send a real message, bench Dion Phaneuf. I mean, that if you bench your captain, the guys are going to come out and play harder, right? And
who's one of their better defenders, though, recently.
Recently, yes. And, you know, and recently they've also, you know, they're 10-4-1 or whatever in their last 15. So, I mean, a lot of these warts are being covered up by points in the standings, for sure. And I'm not putting it all on Dion or whatever, and I know he's been better as of late. But that's how you send a message. You don't publicly chastise your kids playing the hardest position in hockey.
And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned kind of their propensity to give up that first goal as well, because I think they're right at the bottom of the league in terms of wins after trailing in the first period, something like that.
And they've only had one loss this season after having the lead after the first period, scoring the first goal of a hockey game, in fact.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that kind of stuff speaks volumes about your team's makeup, you know, and
yeah, it's also, I'm kind of blown away that John actually said something positive about Dion Phaneuf. It kind of went under the radar there. I don't know if you caught it, but yes, John Gregg said something positive about the Maple Leafs captain, Dion Phaneuf.
Well, you can't see it right now, but he's actually also wearing his jersey at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. I think there was a glitch in the Matrix there. You're listening to Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis, alongside John Gregg and Dave Zarum of Sportsnet Magazine. Maple Leafs resume their season tomorrow in sunny South Florida. The East does stink, right? Like, the Penguins look good, and they're mumping right now. We know it's taken over the National Hockey League, and Marc-Andre Fleury looks pretty good, but let's see him do it in the playoffs, of course. And the Lightning look much improved. But outside of that, and the Islanders are having a pretty good season as well, but untested, to be sure. For all the Leafs' warts, for all the problems they have, for as much as they are leafing, I mean, would we be shocked to see them, you know, pull off what the Montreal Canadiens did last year or the New York Rangers did? Because that was kind of completely out of left field as well.
I'd be shocked.
I wouldn't, only because every team in this conference has its warts. And, you know, one thing we've been leaning towards, more scoring in the playoffs, the Leafs are the highest scoring team in the NHL, you know. If you're Pittsburgh might be the best team in the conference, but if you can shut down one of their two top guys, you could probably beat them with some added depth, right? I mean, Detroit's best players are older. You know, the Rangers are the Rangers. They don't score a lot of goals, but they, you know, they managed to eke their way through the playoffs last year. And, you know, let's not forget that the Leafs 2 years ago took the Stanley Cup finalists from the East to within 12 minutes of beating them in the first round, and they are a better team now.
What happened to those 12 minutes? I blanked out.
Now, I think a lot of people blanked out, but they are a better team. I'm not here to say that the Toronto Maple Leafs are an Eastern Conference, champion in the making. I'm just here to say that all of these teams have their issues, and any one of them, all you need is a chip and a chair in the East, and you can get in.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. As far as the West, though, a little different story. And the Blackhawks seem like a pretty good team once again. Some other news in the NHL just kind of breaking right now. We saw Peter DeBoer was fired yesterday on Boxing Day. That's harsh, man. I guess
it wasn't Christmas.
Boxing Day. I guess you feel a little bit bad about making thousands of dollars worth of purchases on Boxing Day, though, and you have no job. So that was kind of harsh.
He'll be all right.
Yeah, I guess. He's still getting paid. Remember, he did join that team, take him to a Stanley Cup final in his first season, missed the playoffs the next 2 years. They're pretty brutal right now. They can't score at all. And here's what's going to happen, apparently. Lou Lamoriello is going to be, at least on the surface, the man in charge. He's not naming himself the head coach, not even naming himself the interim head coach. But he will stand on the bench. And Scott Stevens, who was already an assistant there, will continue to be an assistant, but he will take care of the defense. Adam Oates is going to be hired. He will take care of the forwards. And those guys are kind of almost going to have like an open tryout to be the next head coach of the New Jersey Devils. I've never heard anything like this. It seems kind of like a weird dynamic. I mean, for those guys to go through strategy before game, Stevens and Oates, isn't that going to be a pretty weird scenario?
I mean, it almost sounds like a NFL team, like an offensive coordinator, sure, defensive coordinator in hockey. I don't know how that's going to work.
I mean, I think it's indicative of going out and trying to find the right guy in the offseason. Like, I don't think either Oates or Stevens are the head coach of the New Jersey Devils next year. If they were going to be, why not make one of them now? And Lou is basically going to stand behind the bench. I mean, you can't tell me he's not pulling the strings, and it's no different than being the head coach and having your two assistants. One runs the D, one runs the forwards, right? I you know, he's out there looking to upgrade his roster in the offseason, and he's looking to upgrade the behind the bench. And whether that's Dan Bylsma or anybody else, it's not going to be either of these two guys.
Are you surprised Bylsma's name hasn't surfaced that much with any of the vacancies or any of the moves? I mean, I guess he's not going to go to Edmonton, right? Like, he can kind of pick and choose.
He can pick and choose. He's one of those guys where, you know, he's going to cost you $2 million a year, and he can decide where he wants to go and what environment he wants to jump into next. He's, you know, he's Babcockian in that way.
And he's earned it, right?
He has earned it, for sure. I mean, every coach is hired to be fired, and everybody's message gets stale at some point on some teams. And, you know, but Bylsma has shown nothing but that he's one of the better coaches around, and he'll be fine. He'll be somewhere next year for sure.
And he's got a great nickname. Disco is not bad. There's only been three head coaches fired this season in the NHL, which is, I feel like, kind of low. I feel like there's been seasons previous where we've seen a whole bunch of firings. But just three, I guess, does that speak to the parity in the NHL? I mean, there's some bad teams that are bad and have excuses for being bad. I mean, Carolina's bad. They've suffered some pretty devastating injuries. We know the Sabres have almost overachieved despite being dead last in the Atlantic Division. And Ted Nolan, like, there was a point here where you were thinking, like, man, that guy could be coach of the year despite having a team that's last in the NHL.
You know, just to bring it back to when we were talking about the junior tournament earlier, I wonder, in this particular season, how much of that has to do with having guys like Eichel and McDavid coming up, where if you are bottoming out, you know, maybe it's not such a bad thing, and you hold on for another year knowing you're going to reload with one of these kids.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we all in this country, we've been talking about Edmonton for months now, but, mm-hmm. you know, I think pretty much if you look at the standings, I mean, they are kind of falling into place for what you'd think they would have been, you know, 35 games ago when this whole thing first started. So, you know, it's hard to justify firing the coach in Carolina when your team is riddled with injuries and you're rebuilding anyway.
And there's nothing expected of you coming into the season.
Exactly. They were expected to be maybe not battling for last overall, but not to be a good team by any means. And, you know, Calgary, they're free-falling, but, I mean, they were never supposed to be where they were. You know, you could argue...
Bob Hartley's been re-upped, too.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, you could argue maybe, you know, Colorado or Dallas in the West should be better. But, I mean, that's a tough conference. We all know that.
And you're not going to fire Patrick Waugh.
No, not. I don't think you'd want to. And you're not going to do that if you're Joe Sakic. I mean, Patrick Waugh is almost like a GM in his own right
I would hate to have that conversation with him too, right?
I mean, what does it take for Patrick Waugh to get fired? He kind of has to go out on his own accord at some point. He's like Wayne Gretzky with the Coyotes, right? Like, you can't fire Wayne Gretzky, can't fire Patrick Waugh.
I mean, we also haven't had the, you know, the public kind of display of indifference to your bosses, right? We had, like, Tortorella last year, like, going crazy. So, of course, he gets fired. Now, you could
Ted
say,
Nolan's known for that, but we haven't seen it yet.
No, you can say, you know, Paul McLean kind of, you know, started up with some backhanded compliments and whatnot in Ottawa, and that might have got him canned. But, I mean, we just haven't had the scenarios that lead to firings, I don't believe.
I just hope Ted Nolan's around when the Sabres are good, right? Like, it seems like it would be such a shame if he's out of there for either his own choice or somebody else's when the Sabres have these good young players and they're coming into their own and they're back in the upswing of the cycle. Because I feel like he has done an outstanding job, and he spent so much time in hockey purgatory, right? Blacklisted, it seemed like. I'm just happy to see him, you know, back in the NHL, and the Sabres no longer really the laughingstock of the NHL. They were at the beginning of the season. It's clearly Edmonton now who still, you know, they've lost eight straight after that 11-game losing streak. So 19 of 20 they've lost and still suck in single digits in wins on the season, which is unbelievable. Although the record against the Eastern Conference is like, they're like one game under 500 against the East.
Yeah.
It's the West that they have one win all season against. This year, but certainly.
It really is amazing what's going on in that city,
right?
Like the mismanagement.
I know you hate bringing
it
up.
I know, but I can't help it. But it's just the mismanagement of that team is just off the charts. And anybody who was a member of the 1980s Edmonton Oilers should not be a member of the 2014-15 Edmonton Oilers front office staff.
Right.
That's where I would start.
It's like a different sport that hockey that was played in the 80s. As opposed to now. And we did talk about Scott Stevens taking over as one of the assistants in New Jersey. I mean, that guy would be getting a 20-game suspension every other week, right? Like, yeah. If he played in the NHL right now.
He cannot teach anybody how to hit.
No, don't do that. Keep him away from Eric Lindros. All right, when we come back, it is week 17 in the NFL. There is still lots to be decided. One game will be played with the winner directly going to the playoffs. That's in the putrid NFC South. But that being said, you know, that team could be favored in their opening round playoff matchup against maybe the Arizona Cardinals. Also, the NFC North will be decided tomorrow. Green Bay and the Detroit Lions, who haven't won at Lambeau in 100 years. And the AFC North will be decided, although both the Bengals and Steelers are headed to the playoffs. But somebody could earn themselves a first-round playoff home game. And the Bengals could even win one of those first-round buys, depending on what happens to the Denver Broncos. So a little NFL talk coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarum and John Grigg on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Welcome to Junior, the CHL podcast with Jeff Merrick and Sam Cosentino. From now until the MasterCard Memorial Cup, this is the destination for news, opinion, and prospects. No one does the CHL like this.
I'm trying to figure out, in my mind, I know they're different types of skaters, but is he just flat out a faster skater than Nathan MacKinnon was in Halifax?
He's a wonderful, wonderful player that never really gets the credit.
Here's our podcast pledge to you, gentle listeners. Sam and I will be sober on that day. How about that? That's our pledge to you.
Yeah, I'm glad you made it.
From now until the MasterCard Memorial Cup, this is the destination for news, opinion, and prospects. Find this story and more on Sportsnet.ca.
My house in Budapest, my hidden treasure chest, golden grand piano, my beauty focused EOU. Ooh, you.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Ennis alongside John Grigg and Dave Zarum. Week 17 in the National Football League. Really, just a couple of playoff spots up for grabs, but lots still on the line tomorrow. Carolina and Atlanta will play in a game that will decide a playoff participant in the lowly NFC South. Yes, New Orleans Saints have already been eliminated, but Carolina currently holding down that four spot in the NFC. It's 6-8-1. They will play the Falcons, and the winner being crowned the NFC South champion. It's in Atlanta, and the winner of that game is likely going to play Arizona in the opening round of the playoffs, and it's an Arizona Cardinals team with either Ryan Lindley or Logan Thomas, and I don't think either guy should scare you. So maybe they'll be favored in that game. Also, division titles on the line between Green Bay and the Detroit Lions, and the Sunday nighter, it is the Bengals and the Steelers. Both teams are going to be in the playoffs, and the AFC, there's a wild card spot up for grabs, but all San Diego has to do is win, and they're in, and they've got a Kansas City Chiefs team without Alex Smith, who has a lacerated spleen. I talked about this on Sportsnet Central yesterday. Like, there's some injuries that kind of sound like lame, like turf toe. Like, who's going to be upset if you got turf toe? Although it's pretty painful. Lacerated spleen, that's something I can get behind is, you know what, maybe you should sit this one out. Lacerated spleen. I'm probably not coming in to host this radio show if I have a lacerated spleen.
No. Well, you probably couldn't drive.
I guess not.
Yeah.
I really don't know.
I lacerated my spleen on the way here, and I'm still sitting here. Yeah. I don't know what your excuse is.
Yeah, I can tell.
It's really too bad what's happened in Arizona this year, right?
After the way they started.
The way they started, and they're hosting the Super Bowl, and there was actually a chance that, like, a home Super Bowl game was going to be able to happen, right?
After missing the playoffs last year with 11 wins.
Yeah, and I mean, they're doing it with a defense that's making up for the fact that, you know, Larry Fitzgerald has been hobbled all season. They're down to their third or fourth quarterback now after, you know, Carson Palmer. I mean, man, signs another big ticket deal and gets hurt the next week. That's the second time that's happened in his career. I mean,
yeah, both quarterbacks have gone down in games against the St. Louis Rams.
Yeah, I mean, it was looking like there might be a Cinderella story there through the first part of the season. And now, you know, as you say, they might be underdogs to an under .500 team in the playoffs.
I mean, my question when I look at the NFL standings right now with the last week ahead of us is, you know, there are the teams that we all have a lot of confidence in, you know, Denver, New England, Seattle. But I guess my question is, when you look at these teams, who are you least trusting of the playoff teams?
Denver. I don't think I'm very trusting of Denver, especially really? The way Peyton Manning's looked last couple of games against the Bengals, looked horrible with the 4 picks.
That's right.
And he just doesn't look healthy. I don't know if he's sick. I don't know what's going on there. But, yeah, and especially considering the Denver playoff failures, although, I mean, they made a Super Bowl last year, so you got to give them credit there. But, yes, the Peyton Manning playoff thing, I mean, I don't think it's even close unless, you know, you think that the Patriots have been playing over their head. I don't. I think they have, for the first time in a long time, actually pretty good defense. I mean, and Seattle, right? The defending champs. If you had to pick a favorite, though, right now out of Seattle and New England, who would it be? That's a tough one. I mean, that's either Seattle, New England, or Green Bay, New England is the dream matchup. Maybe Green Bay, New England, because we already saw them play in the regular season and it was a great, great game.
Yeah, I think you like to see the quarterback matchup too, right? So, I mean, Rodgers versus Brady would be, you know, one for the ages and two of the best quarterbacks of their generation, no doubt about that. But I like to see Richard Sherman in the Super Bowl again. I think that would be entertaining. I like watching Seattle play. I think Russell Wilson is an excellent quarterback. One of the, you know, might not have the gun that other guys have, but he is a game manager and he does exactly what needs to be done pretty much every down. And he's not afraid to run the ball when needed, take a hit whenever it's needed, and he can still air it out pretty well.
And I still think, you know, the way those guys just get after it on both ends of the ball, but particularly on defense, and special teams. I think, like, in the playoffs, that's something that really, really can be too much to overcome, you know, as we saw last year.
Well, speaking of teams that run the ball pretty well, the Dallas Cowboys are one of those teams. They don't have a great defense, but they just control the clock so much, they don't need to rely on it that much. And they're a team everybody likes to talk about, and everybody has a point of view, right? It's a very polarizing team, the Dallas Cowboys, and they've been easy to dump on the last few years, finishing 8-8 seemingly every single season, and Jason Garrett coming back for another year, and Tony Romo, the Shakespearean character that he is, failing in late game situations, throwing soul crushing interceptions. But instead of crushing your soul in December, I mean, they've risen to the challenge, you know, putting away a game against the Eagles in which they blew a 21-point lead, came back immediately and scored, have clinched the division. You could see them tripping over their own feet this week, maybe, if there was something on the line, but there isn't. They are 11-4 and are going to win that NFC East. Is it all gravy now for the Cowboys, or do they now become the Dallas Cowboys of old, where you have high expectations and Tony Romo could still shoot himself in the foot?
You know, I actually really like what the Cowboys have done this season. I mean, obviously, 11-4 is nothing not to like there, but even with all their history of, you know, coming up short in the playoffs and having to rely on Romo. You summed up well the Shakespearean tragedy. But, you know, you look at what DeMarco Murray's been done. Yeah, he's been hurt a little bit lately, but I think come playoff time, he'll be healthy. I think that's a team that can maybe surprise people. I mean, they surprised people all year. We thought they were going to be last place in the NFL.
There was
right?
a point where we thought they were the best team in the NFL when they beat the Seattle Seahawks.
That's right,
there.
Yeah.
That was a legitimate conversation people mm-hmm. were having.
So I think that's a good football team that maybe, because they're so polarizing, because of their history, their popularity, whatever it is, that maybe we don't give them enough credit for what they've done this season. I think, you know, I look in that conference, I mean, I have more faith in the Cowboys than I do in the Lions, who have the same record as them.
Yeah.
For example.
And even go ahead, John.
Well, I mean, to take it back to your first question, I mean, Dallas for me is the team I have no faith in.
Yeah.
You know, early in the year, we all did think that they had this great defense. Turns out that wasn't the case. They were just controlling the ball a lot. Mm-hmm. You look in Detroit, Dave, I mean, there's a defense, right?
Yes,
I mean,
yeah.
There's the best defensive line in football, and they've got a quarterback who can throw it and an all-time great wide receiver. I mean, they're a quick strike offense with a dominating defense. I mean, I think that's a team that could really step up and surprise.
I mean, I just look at that team, and it's interesting because of what we've been used to from them. Their offense hasn't really, I don't have as much faith in that offense as I have in past years, you know, regardless of the Stafford and Megatron.
They're definitely not scoring like they have in past years, but I think that's also because they don't need to, right? I mean, they're dominating the other side of the ball like they've never done before.
They're winning games on defense. There's no question about that. But I think, you know, in the playoff time, you need to be able to come up with that one play. And, you know, if anyone can limit Megatron, I mean, I don't think they can pull it up.
I think we'll see tomorrow. I mean, against Green Bay with the division title up for grabs. I mean, this is the biggest test of the year for Detroit for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, and you could argue just because of the timing for Green Bay as well. But mm-hmm. I mean, and the numbers and the history are fully in Green Bay's
20
favor.
20-plus losing streak, game losing streak for the Lions in Green Bay at Lambeau Field.
Also, I mean, when you look at the Lions, when you look at the point differential, I mean, it's shockingly low. They've been playing a lot of close games. So on one hand, yeah, you know, that proves something, I suppose. But on the other hand, I mean, they're maybe they've been lucky to 11 wins.
I mean, they shut down Green Bay earlier this year on the carpet in Detroit as well, right? So, I mean, if you can do it there, you can do it anywhere. And I mean, if it's cold and snowy in Green Bay and you're not, it's not a 36-34 game, then you got to give the tough D the benefit of the doubt on that one.
I mean, see,
I felt like you were going to break into New York for a second. But yeah, the Packers, I mean, you mentioned that game, shutting down the Packers. Bills did that as well, who have a great defense. And the Packers, I know everybody's, you know, Aaron Rodgers, Green Bay, they're 11-4. Yeah, I get it. 7-0 at home. On the road, they are 4-4. They are beatable. They are gettable. They lost in New Orleans to what we now understand is a bad Saints team. They have some bad losses, right? Like, they you can shut them down if you get them on the road. So that being said, I mean, tomorrow's game for a first-round playoff home date is huge for them. You're talking about the Packers and their inability to win away from Lambeau Field.
Yeah, and they need to start proving soon that they can do that, because obviously they got one game left until the playoffs. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why I look at that conference. I think Seattle is the team that scares me more, to go back to your way, way first question, more so than Green Bay.
Yeah, it's going to be fun to see what goes down tomorrow and then right into the playoffs in the NFL.
I worry, though, about a Seattle-New England Super Bowl. I feel like there is just although there's a couple of great offensive players on both those teams, I worry that you're looking at a 17-14 kind of like, oh, God, here we go again game. Because D's are so good, right?
I would take that over what we had last year, though, John,
sure.
Wouldn't you?
Yeah, okay,
where
sure.
It was over in, like, the first quarter?
Yeah, you'd always take that. But, I mean, it feels like the Super Bowl needs to be 36-34,
yeah.
You know?
I think broadcasters would be okay with Seahawks and Patriots just because there's so many characters they can trot out and bring in the casual fan that way.
Yeah.
But I hear what you're saying in terms of the actual product on the field.
I want to see Giselle yelling at all the Patriots.
At Richard Sherman?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Giselle. They should bill that one as Richard Sherman and Giselle. Before we go, the top of the clock here, want to revisit our Raptors conversation. As mentioned, in action this afternoon at 3:30 in L.A. against the Clippers on Sportsnet. And it's a key stretch of games for them. We've said that, I feel like, a couple of times this season. And yes, they've gone on a streak of beating sub-500 teams. They had six in a row there. They beat them all. Yet, it doesn't always happen that good teams beat bad teams. I mean, bad teams beat good teams all the time. The Sixers came back from 20-plus points down to beat the Heat. Not that the Heat are a good team. I mean, they're a sub-500 team now at 14-16. They did beat the Cleveland Cavaliers. But there's got to be something to be said for that. And if we want to rip Randy Carlyle for lack of motivation for a Leafs team that is lousy against sub-500 teams, got to give Dwayne Casey a little credit for having his team ready to play against the lesser lights.
There's no debate. I mean, you got to love what Casey's done with this group. And it really goes back to his first season here in Toronto 3 years ago, when he kind of built for the first time in a long time an actual defensive core or a defensive fundamentals for a Raptors team, which was like an oxymoron. Back in the day, but then now you've seen them take the defense that he's built and they've kind of bought into, and now they've helped that initiate their offense. So now you see a team that's averaging 108 points a game. They're doing a lot of it because they're on the strength of their defense, you know, using transition points, things of that nature. It helps when you have a ton of guards like that. But basically with the Raptors, I just see a team where everybody's buying into what the coach is selling. And maybe that's where it's different with Carlisle.
Well, you know, we had a little bit of this debate in the break as well about where this team is defensively compared to a year ago, because I look at that team a year ago, and that game against the Pacers, I think, is when it all changed for me last year, when I thought, man, we're watching something special here, because they clamped down as well as anybody in the NBA last year. They played smothering defense. Now, they weren't nearly the offensive team that they are this year, But I just don't see that same defensive, I don't know if it's mindset, scheme, whatever. And maybe part of it is the fact that DeMar DeRozan's not in the lineup as well. But, I mean, I don't think this team a year ago was allowing 49 points in a fourth quarter. They're maybe not competing against a Bulls team like this one, but it's a little alarming, the number of points that they've allowed, opponents are averaging over 100 points a game. Them and the Bucks are the only team in the top eight in the Eastern Conference that are doing that.
I mean, in general, I think you're seeing the Raptors play at a little faster pace, a more offensive-oriented game. So their points per game are way up, and there too, so are their opponents. I think that's only natural.
And they played in some blowouts too, where teams have come back.
Exactly. I mean, that'll bring the score. But when I look at the team this year, I mean, the metrics may be a little down on them defensively, but I actually like them a little bit better from that standpoint, mostly because of the addition of a guy like James Johnson, which was a kind of dimension that they just did not have last season. I think not enough is being made of how impressive his second turn in Toronto has been, especially, you know, the last few games of replacing Landry Fields, who went down.
Well, yeah, what did you make of Fields in the starting five?
First of all, you feel for the guy because every time he makes a step forward, he gets hurt. I mean,
he's actually almost, he was earning that money there for a couple of seconds.
For a couple of games, yeah. It was a ballsy move putting him in the first place.
Right.
If you're Casey.
Out of nowhere. Like, how do you go from a guy being buried, not even, he's a DNPCD, like, eight straight games before that, ends up in the starting lineup against LeBron James.
And performs well, and that's kind of the story of the team this year, is, you know, the whole, everyone talks about a lot, next man up. But they have the guys who are coming in and fulfilling a role, whatever that role is, you know, and it changes day to day for a lot of these guys.
Maybe Greg Steensman is going to be the next guy.
And that's Dwayne Casey's MO, right? Is he's like, we were talking about Randy Carlyle earlier. He is the exact opposite of Randy Carlyle. He is the motivational guy, the guy who will put in the systems to make you win and will put his players in the right positions to give them the confidence that they need to go out and be, you know, the deepest team in the NBA, right?
You know, you mentioned with Carlisle, maybe you should have been benching Phaneuf. Casey has shown, you know, hey, Valanciunas, you're not starting off right. You may be our center of the future. You know, say hello to the bench for now. And he's willing to make those moves. I think it's interesting with him from a motivational aspect because he's not a traditional, like, raw kind of motivational guy. What he is, you know, he holds everyone accountable, and he is so steady in that kind of message that if you're not gonna follow along, you know, he'll go on without you.
Right.
And they don't have a coach killer. A lot of people thought that was Kyle Lowry's MO when he came over from the Houston Rockets, but they figured out that there's no J.R. Smith. There's no, I don't know, maybe Josh Smith is a coach killer. There's no Swaggy P, although I like Swaggy P, but there isn't that guy on this team.
Yeah, no, there's not. I mean, maybe James Johnson was that guy before when it didn't work out for him here. And, you know, I think it's more of a question of his kind of maturity.
You don't question James Johnson either. He's a black belt.
And his dad is a 7-time kickboxing world champion.
Yeah, you don't mess with him.
I mean, that's, you know, in that brawl with Detroit, I mean, that's why I don't think anyone was really...
No. Yeah, his hands are registered lethal weapons.
So, there you go.
So this is the game today, though, right? If they don't win this game, they can't go 500 on this trip. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think it's difficult. I think they have a shot against both Portland and Golden State. I do. I think they can compete in those games. I think it'll be a huge accomplishment if they win those games. Mm-hmm. But I don't see either of those as like a surefire blowout. Portland is the tougher game for me at this point, despite Golden State's record, because of how Lillard's been playing, how Damian Lillard's been playing. He's just been out of his skull. But you know, I guess today is the key game. Like you said, you want to get that win, get off the road trip on the right foot, but I think there's winnable games throughout the West Coast trip.
Before we go, we haven't touched that much on the West, but if you had to handicap the best team in the West right now, they're all so good, and even the Spurs, who are that 7th seed, right? They've gone to triple overtime a couple of times in the last 2 weeks. Golden State, they've had a bit of a step back, lost back-to-back games, but they're still a half game up on the Blazers. And
Dallas, what does Rondo do for Dallas? I mean, that's just the scariest starting five in the league, right?
He had a pretty good shooting day the other day.
And you think about what Dallas has done in the last, 15 months or so, added 18 months. Monte Ellis, Rajon Rondo, Tyson Chandler, Chandler Parsons. I mean, that's a team that's rebuilt itself on the fly while remaining a contender. So I really like what they've done there. One team, though, when you talk about the West, is the Thunder. Now that they got their guys back,
Westbrook's kind of been out of his mind recently.
Westbrook's been amazing with Durant out of the lineup. And Durant, you know, if he is in the lineup, and I think he will be by the playoff time, that's a team that I'm really, really looking at as a real finals.
They're going to have a tough road, though, right? I mean, they're going to be
every
a lower
team
seed.
In the West.
I know, but you're going to go up against the Golden State or whoever.
Yeah. Got to beat him eventually, I guess. Hey, gents, thanks a lot for this. Really enjoyed it. When we come back, it is an edition of Sportsnet Today. We'll get you set for World Juniors and talk a little more round ball as well. I'm Ben Ennis. This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live with John Grigg and Dave Zarum on the Sportsnet Radio Network.